Workshopping, sixth of the dusk.
Critiquing Brandon's story. I'm Brandon.
I'm Dan.
I'm Mary.
I'm Howard.
We are going to be doing a critique of my story, Sixth of the Dusk, which is the psychic bird story that we brainstormed about a year ago. What they have read here is the unedited version, because right now I haven't done the edited version. I'm just assuming I'm going to, and it's going to be awesome. The other thing that I'm going to do is we're going to run this like I run my writing group. So in my writing group, the thing we do is we start off talking just briefly about what's working in the story, so that the author doesn't accidentally go take that out, doesn't screw it up. We talk about what's good, what's fun, what's what we enjoyed. Then we go on to large-scale problems and talk about big issues that that we think the story just... That are big problems. And from there, we talk about some more medium level issues. So let's start off Sixth of the Dusk. What did you guys like?
Well, I thought the world building was a lot of fun. It made sense. It was compelling. The journey across the island was tense, and you managed the geography, I thought, quite well. The characters were distinct and consistent. And the prose was serviceable.
Okay.
Which I wouldn't say to anyone normally, but
yes, this is one of my first drafts. And if my first drafts have a weakness, it is the prose. The prose is, yeah. Anyway,
actually, the way you had described the prose, I was expecting it to be awful, and
it's just wordy. And each sentence could be a little tighter, yeah. But yeah.
Mm-hmm. I liked the details in it, in particular about not just, you know, you don't just tell us the main character is a trapper, but you actually show us and have invented all of this terminology for the animals and the plants and the tricks that he uses and the culture that he's from. It's very well developed and really pulls you into the story.
I liked the, first of all, I enjoyed the whole, you know, the whole story, beginning, middle, end. I thought that the plot structure worked, the shape, the emotional arc of things was shaped right. The reveals felt like they were, for the most part, in the right places. The thing that it struck me the most, that I think I liked the most, was the subverting of the noble savage trope. Your trapper recognizes that metal tools and pants are superior to what his people have been using for a long time, and so he's just fine with metal tools and trousers and boots and these things, and I liked that.
Now, what I did here is I wrote all of this down with the name of the person who said it, because usually when I'm going to do a revision, I'm going to set this aside for a while, and I'll come back, and I want to know kind of the context, know who said what. This is because I know my writing group, and I know sometimes to pay a better attention if someone I know is specialized in a certain thing, they do a really good job with it. Like Howard talks about, this is where your humor was working. I'm like, okay, I need to look at that and see what was I doing that actually made Howard laugh, you know, something like that. Now we'll move on to the large-scale problems.
I have one more thing that I wanted to say before we leave the good stuff.
Yes.
Is just that I was, and this is a minor note, and I know this was your intention the whole time, but it's worth pointing out that you successfully wrote a very unique world. I mean, fantasies set in jungles are few and far between, and so this stands out just because of that.
Okay.
Yeah, and you did manage to make psychic birds make sense. Mm-hmm. So kudos for that.
All right. Big issues. And in my writing group, it's not person taking a turn. Just throw out, and then I encourage everyone to have a conversation about what they felt about that.
Does the dude's name count as a big issue?
It sure can.
Yeah.
If it's big to you, it counts.
It was not by any means the biggest problem in the story, but sixth, that is a really hard word to say, and it was really getting on my nerves by the end. I was wishing he had an older brother so he could be seventh, just because that's easier
to
say.
Because then he's seventh of nine, which was the thing that triggered for me at the beginning.
Mm.
See, the problem I had is that...
fifth, though.
You
fifth
are going to
fourth,
have...
Because then you don't have a... Sorry.
You're going to have a whole pile of... Just statistically speaking, you're going to have... Every other child is going to be named either first or second.
So,
which just seemed.
But that was
weird.
Cool. I'm willing to accept
that's not
naming convention.
That's not unusual. I mean,
How many Jasons do we have at this retreat?
It's not even that. It's like that's the way they were doing things in Rome. That's the way they do things in China, that people go by, you know, their birth order.
That's a fair cop. If the first name is more like a surname, they don't have surnames. So many of you are going to be first, second, or third. It seems to me that what would actually be differentiating you is what comes later, which for him is dusk, which mm-hmm. turns out to not be time of day.
You know, a triple consonant cluster, when it gets possessive, it's a mm-hmm. quadruple consonant cluster, was just hard for me to say every time.
Got it.
But we'll move on.
So you're ending.
Oh, dear.
Basically, what I feel like is going on is that you've got, and you did ask about it specifically, mm-hmm. but you've got basically a triple ending going on. And the reason I think that's happening, so you've got the thing where they defeat the monster, which is not really the ending because that's an internal event. The bigger event that they have to solve is the stopping of the machine,
the mapping machine,
which they do, and then he leaves and goes out off to sea, and then he comes back, and then they go away. So the leaving and going off to sea was a second ending, and then the going out into space is your third ending. I think. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a couple of things going on besides that. One is that you need to combine all of those that you only end once. And because
I'm not sure I agree with that, but keep going.
I think he needs to wrap up all of the problems, but I think the going away and coming back is currently not working.
So you're saying not the defeat the monster, but the other ending.
Right. No, the defeat the monster mm-hmm. I don't count as okay. an ending. Mm-hmm. That's
But the ones you're saying combined is stop the machine, go away, then come back.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, the going away worked in a sense. It's obviously in there because you knew that you needed to separate those two endings in some way. Combining them is one solution, or just giving him a reason to come back, which is absent in this story. I think if he leaves, I liked having the breather to go out and look at the island, and, you know, look at his father, and then come back. But there wasn't anything bringing him back, in my opinion.
Yeah, I agree with that. But I think and this is where I was going to head with the very, very end, with his decision to come back and then go into space, is that at the beginning of the story, he is not dissatisfied with his life. You know, he has a life that he likes. He feels like he's good at his job. And yes, the job is changing, but there's nothing about his life that indicates that he's lonely or that he wants to leave. And you end with him taking her hand, which symbolizes a connection with someone else. And there's nothing about the way his life is structured that indicates that the fact that he is not connecting with other people is a problem. There's, you know, none of that seems to be an issue for him. So I think if you want to keep that part of it, that you have to go back to the beginning and insert something so that he is somewhat dissatisfied. I mean, if we're using the classic my structure,
yes.
mm-hmm. Right now you have basically, you have milieu story, and then you have an event, and then you wrap up the event, and you wrap up the milieu, and then you suddenly have this character
yep.
ending, and it's like, hello, where did this come from? And then he goes away, which resolves the, I am not satisfied with my status, my position in life. And also you have introduced, there's two disruptions to the status quo. One is the what is happening to the birds, which represents the larger disruption. So there's that, and then there's also that we have space aliens coming down to visit us. Those are both related things. Right now you have them as two separate things with the way the ending is structured. So that's, I think that you would have a stronger emotional punch if you could find a way to either have him come to that decision at the end after the after they defeat. I also like him going back out to sea, but I don't think it's working.
It's not. And so he either needs to go, like I said, he needs to go out to sea and then have a compelling reason, something that drives him back, or there needs to be, we need to remove the need for him to go out to sea.
Yeah. And I think that you could remove the need for him to go back to sea. I mean, if we're looking at the classic, you know, milieu structure, the story starts when a character enters a place or leaves a place and, you know. Mm-hmm. We could count the entrance into the fortress as the exiting from the island. You know, that he arrives on the island with his on his boat, but he is leaving via another door. And that could count if... if you go back to the beginning and add in some character stuff.
Or just having him get onto their other boat, their yeah. big iron boat.
Yeah, and watch
coming on a little canoe and leaving on the big iron boat
yeah.
solves that very subtle problem. But yeah. we keep interrupting Howard.
Well, I just wanted to say one thing about that, and then we can Howard talk.
We're going to continue interrupting Howard.
Yes, I am, because that's my job.
This is Mary's expertise, so I'm kind of willing to let Mary just talk.
That's hilarious. But I just wanted to second what Dan said, in particular because putting him on the iron boat allows you to have that looking back at the island, and that is a really strong image.
Yeah. I actually had a process question.
I'm just joking.
I had a process question. I'll be blunt, Dan and Mary are fixing it.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the sort of critique that you're accustomed to getting?
Oh, that's a good question. From my writing group, and particularly from Dan, I always want Dan to fix my story. Okay. Now, here's the thing. This may be a bad example for you all, because I am sitting with two of the authors I respect most in the world, and with Howard.
That's just fine.
Dan and I know each other really
yeah.
well.
Yeah, yeah.
We have been workshopping together forever, and we know each other's stories. And in some cases, this can be a bad thing in that, you know, since we know what the other's trying for, sometimes you get into trouble where since Dan knows my writing so well, he'll miss things that are wrong because he just assumes he knows what I was trying for and he's right.
Yeah.
But a really good critiquer can dig into this is the problem and here are ways to fix it. Now, you may not take those ways, and I'm an experienced critiquee. It's okay. I'm an experienced critiquee, and I know when to not... You're snickering at that. I know when to not take advice and when to take it. And so allowing two really good writers to go back and forth on what's wrong with my writing and what to fix it, I'm perfectly willing to let happen. In fact, I'm excited by it. But a lot of new workshoppers, I suggest them not do this, that they describe their emotions and not give you fixes.
And I'm going to second you on that.
Yeah.
If I were critiquing someone else,
yes.
I would not be offering the
right.
prescription.
Because I'm actively soliciting help, which is a different thing also.
One of the things that I think failed with this ending is that while I could feel the presence of the various emotional threads, those various pieces, they didn't all hit close enough together. And I think that's a good way to sum up what Mary said last week, is that, you know, we weren't... all of these things kind of needed to happen, but they needed to happen closer. Outside the Hollywood formula, the two biggest problems I had is that I wanted clues, I wanted some foreshadowing with regard to Dusk a little bit earlier. That was a neat reveal. I liked that, but when by the end of the story we realized that he's kind of mulling over his name as a foretelling, I thought maybe he should have been mulling over his name as a foretelling earlier. And maybe that's the discontent that he's feeling that Mary suggested. And the second issue is that I think we were almost halfway through the story before we mentioned that they had made contact with people from the stars, and that needed to drop a little bit sooner.
That needed to at least be hinted at earlier. I don't mind the revelation coming where it
does. Oh, the revelation was awesome.
But I was not prepared for it.
Yeah.
Yep. Ditto that.
All right.
I said
it's actually
smart
on
things.
Page two. Yes. But
it's on page two?
It is on page two.
Well, obviously none of us saw
two?
It.
Yeah.
All right, I'm flipping
and
to page two.
If you feel
two,
the
and
need
gonna...
to defend your story, that means it's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. Here's my thing. This is actually even more so than the ending. This is what this was my biggest problem with the
Where
story.
Where is that on page two?
The ones above.
That is
just
so
search
not
for
on page
ones above.
There's ones above.
Oh, please.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. Sixth gives away so much information for no reason that I could discern. He focuses so heavily on the fact that he doesn't like talking, that this woman talks too much, and then he just cannot stop himself from spilling every secret he knows, and he doesn't get anything out of it. He's not trying to get anything from her. It felt very weird to me, like he was just, you know, the plot engine would take over, and it's like, oh, we need to know another secret now, so he's just going to tell us.
Yeah, I had some issues with that. I felt like a lot of his motivation for why he was telling her, that people already know this and it's going to come out. And I felt like usually there was motivation behind that I could accept it. But there were a couple of places where I'm like, why are you telling her this?
See, and if that's his motivation, I think it would need to be accompanied by his reaction.
Yeah.
You know, not just an acceptance, but some form of guilt or betrayal or whatever.
Yeah.
And that was there a little bit, but not enough to sell it.
Yeah, and also I think that if that had been present in the beginning when I was talking about needing some form of him being dissatisfied with life, if he was doing some of that in the beginning before he even meets her, mm-hmm. you know, that, you know, maybe there's some form of, if they've got steam, you know, they've got probably newspapers or something that you know, some article had been published, and he's like, people are starting to talk about stuff that has traditionally been kept between us.
And
also, Ones Above is not until page 22.
Okay, maybe I just... yes.
I could not find it on page 2.
Okay.
So the seeds
22
are
of
there.
75.
That's like page 2 for a shorter story.
It's got two twos
of
in it.
Of seven.
The seeds are there for him to have this kind of letting go of the past aspect.
Yeah.
You know, we're planting early on that he's wearing kind of more modern clothes. He has a compass. He has the little scuba mask that he talks about. But he completely accepts that, whereas he... I don't know what I'm... No, Brandon knows what I mean at this point.
Brandon, what does Dan mean?
Dan means that he doesn't like the story. he's talking about the... Well, I try to avoid talking too much, but he's talking about the idea he's accepting all of these things, but is there any regret? Is there any sense of loss? I mean, he's just moving along with it, and is that a wasted opportunity or not?
Yeah, and I completely agree with that, and I think that if you can give us hints of that in the beginning, that will inform a lot of the decisions he makes later.
The other thing that I wanted to say, the other seed that is being sown there, is that he, by bringing in mainland birds, has already started to corrupt the island. And that was never brought up.
That's true.
And never addressed. Yeah. And could, if that's a direction you decide to go, solve some of this problem, that he's already party to the corruption of the island.
Yeah. And I thought that you dealt with that a little bit when he was all, let's kill all of the night moths. Mm-hmm. I thought that the bird he had, that sack, was a mainland bird that had like been blown off course, that he just got lucky with that one. But you're right, he is bringing chicks in now because he's saying there will be more of these.
Mm-hmm.
Good point. And, you know, and that may be one of those things where he is not aware of the ecosystem issues that he's going to cause by doing that. And that's something she could bring up and have him, you know, make those connections.
Yeah.
That is a neat piece of symmetry. You know, the groundwork is already laid for that, where he is worried about change. He recognizes himself as an agent of change. His name means he is an agent of change. Mm-hmm. But he does not recognize the extent of the change that would occur if he does what he wants.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas she is, she is definitely an agent of change. You know, mm-hmm. she's there as part of changing things. But her mission is to change things while at the same time protecting them in a way that hasn't occurred to him. And there's a neat symmetry there.
Yeah.
And that's the sort of thing which, Brandon, you do a great job with in the other stuff of yours that I've read where you've had a chance to tighten up the prose. Those are the things that just naturally flow out as you're tightening up these words. You realize, oh, I need to use this word here and then this word again here. And the reader grabs that symmetry without you having to throw down a whole paragraph mm-hmm. that says, and this is what he believed.
Yep.
So.
All right. Well, let's continue to it. Continue to thrash my story, everyone. What are your medium-level problems? Just things that occurred to you that may not require big revision, but that bothered you.
This is a tiny thing. It's actually just a order of information flow. When it's on page 7, when you introduce the sack, the AVR usually waited until they'd landed before bestowing her blessing. And I'm like, the corpse is a vision? Because I wasn't completely clear, and then why is that a blessing? Why is the vision of a corpse a blessing? And you answer it like 2 sentences later, but because it's, you know, the 2 sentences are the black feathered bird just watched the waves, and sixth continued, you're right, that is hard to say. Sixth continued his work.
You have an audiobook problem here.
Yeah. I thought you were done, and I thought that I wasn't going to get the answer, and so I was confused. And I really think that it's just, you know, just moving the body he saw and the, you know, moving that little section somewhere just, you know, so there's not quite that tiny buffer between would have fixed that for me. And it's a small thing.
Got it.
Yeah, medium level-ish thing for me was the mechanic of, and I guess it's a mixture of things, the mechanic of the foretelling. We never get at any point a vision from Sack that tells us something that then comes true. So, I mean, he's been very careful and he's survived all of this time as a result of stuff from Sack, but I've never seen Sack do something or tell him something and then see that actual thing actually happen, which I know wouldn't work because we're only getting his corpses.
Yeah, but what we do see is Sack give the warning and him look closer, and it's like, oh yes, in fact.
Oh yes, there's a thing there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like with the vines coming out of the tree.
Yeah, well, see, and that's why I'm saying it's a medium level problem. Yeah. If I could see one of those prophecies come true, I would be much more satisfied in the bird's ability. The other thing that was a little weird is the concatenation of his corpse everywhere, which...
was awesome.
It was
intense?
Awesome. No, I
yeah.
liked it. It was powerful. It was awesome. But to my mind, it was never explained. I didn't understand why.
I was bothered as well by the fact that we never find out what this mapping machine is or what it's going to do to the island. But I was not super bothered by it. I don't know if I would have even brought it up had Howard not mentioned it, because it's a hole in the story, but it feels like it's an excusable hole in the story because that's not what the story's focusing
yeah,
on.
Yeah, see, I was okay with that. Where I had a problem was that because I thought, well, why would mapping machinery do that? That doesn't make any sense. But then when Sixth says, hey, I think it's because this is a trap and it's not actually mapping machinery, it's designed to cause this disruption.
Mm-hmm.
Liked that reveal a lot. That
I
was
did
cool.
too. But where my problem lay was that I didn't see his logical
yes,
steps to get
I think...
to that. And because we're in his POV and we didn't see him putting those pieces together, we just saw him say, and here, let me give you this piece of exposition.
Yes. And that exposition came out of nowhere. If he arrives there by the same process you just did, mm-hmm. that would solve 2 whole different problems
yeah.
for me at the same time. Here's another problem that I maybe didn't bug anybody else, but the gun that she has, I couldn't figure out why it was a harpoon gun. And to the point that was weird enough to me that I thought, oh, it's going to be important later that it's a harpoon gun. And it is, because you can't tie a flower bulb onto a bullet, and so therefore it had to be a harpoon. And that, as far as I could see, was the only reason for it to be a harpoon. I'm cool with other cultures having other kinds of guns, but this was never used in a way that would make a harpoon more valuable than a bullet.
They had the deep maw or the, whatever the deep creature things that they were up against sometimes. And if you're going to shoot something like that, you do need a heavier projectile than a bullet, because a bullet won't go very far in the water. But she tried shooting at one and missed.
I never got
work.
The sense that this was an underwater
Well, she does say that it was specifically something that they had for the shadow, and that she grabbed it when she was fleeing. But that maybe needs to be brought out a little more.
Okay.
Along these lines, since we're talking about Shadow and Nightmaw and all of these things, oddly, instead of a shark-toothed club, I was like, they have sharks on this world? And I don't know why that bothered me. Because it wouldn't have bothered me if, birds didn't bother me, horses wouldn't have bothered me, but for some reason, shark-toothed, when we have all of these other cool flora and fauna that are clearly indigenous to the world, for some reason, I'm like, why would anyone import sharks? I can understand importing birds, but why would anyone import sharks?
On a related note, but this is actually a good thing that I thought was a neat little minor touch, is you describe the shadows, the big monsters, and you never actually say that they look like krakens or Cthulhus or whatever, but that's what I imagined in my head. But he had literally no idea how to describe it, or maybe it was the girl. And then in like the next sentence, they talk about octopi. And I'm like, well, if they know what an octopi is and they still don't know how to describe what I assumed was a kraken, it must be even weirder than I thought it was. And I thought that was a really neat moment.
I just assumed it was like a really big shark.
I was just like, it's just something bad.
You guys just don't like to imagine tentacles as much as I do.
I had...
Oh, that's not where I went.
Okay.
All right. Again, in that medium level, this was one of the places where it's like, where I did feel like there was an inconsistency. If you had been another trapper, I would have killed you directly rather than leaving you to revenge yourself upon me. But I thought that they didn't kill each other directly. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, well, is that because she's at the safe camp? But because there was an allusion to the only time that they fought was
not
at the
an
safe
allusion,
camp.
But a direct reference.
Yes.
We don't hurt each other. We let the island kill each other. Yeah. We just help it.
Yeah, and so and it was very close to this, so I was confused. Yeah. Either cut or clarify. Let's see, what else did I have?
You're only there. You've got lots more to go.
Oh, yeah. Yes, I do.
The little Meekers were awesome.
Loved the Meekers.
But I was sad that they didn't show up later.
Yes.
Because when he needs to end up, essentially, I imagined him assaulting this enemy fortress. And I thought he was going to rouse his little band of nasty little bitey mice. And instead, he just scared some panthers in the woods, and then we cut.
Yeah.
Jump cut.
Yeah. It is, there were a lot of things in here that were really cool that I love and think you could cut to make this a tighter story.
Yeah.
And the Meekers represent that one of those because you're not using them. Use it or lose it. Have no idea where you would insert them. But since you write long, this is something that you could cut in short.
Originally, they were actually going to kill her.
Oh.
Offhandedly, because he, his paranoia was too. And he had said, but
I'm glad
I
you didn't
decided that when I got there, that was the wrong emotional beat.
Yep.
For this. And so.
Yeah.
So that's why they were put there.
You can cut them now. And use them for something else because they're great. Except I will say that one thing that they do if you are emphasizing this theme of him disrupting island ecology, they do, it is him interfering with the way things naturally work in the island.
The other thing they do is they help reinforce this idea that there is telepathy happening in nature everywhere. It's a broader sort of effect.
Yes. And, the one of the ways you could have them used is that maybe she was not the only person who escaped and that she had a companion that was killed by the Meekers. Getting back to something that Dan had said earlier about, that he just seemed to be spouting information. There was a point where he says, coming here was obviously a disaster. But the rest of the story, he's so annoyed with her saying all of these obvious things. And so the fact that he's actually using the word obviously.
That was a minor thing, but it stood out to me as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess it's minor, but I'm just
well, word not so not just the word choice, but just how verbose mm-hmm. he became.
Yeah.
In those two sentences.
Yeah.
Very wordy.
Yeah. Oh, this is actually something I should have mentioned in the cool stuff. There's a point where he's been using her name for a while and he gets angry at her. And for two paragraphs, he only refers to her as the woman, which was a really nice way of showing that he was like, this is, you know, she is not a person to me.
When your story's climax isn't an ending, Fixing Six of the Dusk by Brandon Sanderson.
Introduction. I'm very excited by how my story for the anthology turned out. The prose flowed very well, and I felt an excitement for the idea from the get-go. Polynesian culture fascinates me, something you can probably see hints of in my other works, and the idea of building a fantasy culture on that framework was exciting. A lot of things worked right from the start for me, including Dusk's personality, his relationship with the island, and his clash with his own people. As I said in the brainstorming session, I like to have an ending in mind when I begin writing a story. Usually when I say ending, I mean climax, that powerful moment when things come together, different threads intertwine, and the character and plot click together. Those are the moments I'm shooting for, and those are the kinds of things I need to be there to pull me through the story. For this story, my outline was very simple. I knew I wanted to make it a cross-island trip so we could experience the dangers of Pachi. I also knew that I wanted to have Dusk interact with someone else, more of an outsider, to both contrast his character and give more depth to the setting. As I worked on the story, the clash between the old and the new became a theme, represented by the two characters. Dusk's resistance to change, along with having him already know the secret to making birds gain talents, came as a natural development. My climax, then, became the information reveal about the nature of the birds both to Vothi and to the reader. I found quickly that I could align this reveal with a tense chase through the jungle, allowing the external conflict to come to a head at the same time that I reached the intellectual climax. Perfect. Except it wasn't. The lesser problem. As I wrote, I ran into two major hang-ups. The first was the question, why? Why a tense chase across the jungle? What would drive the plot, make the protagonist move? My original intention, that of Dusk needing to return Vothi safely to her people, felt lukewarm to me. I wanted a more powerful motivator. I needed to up the stakes. The solution came in the bird that showed Dusk's corpse. I'd put Sack in because I felt her power would be an evocative, cool thing to do with the magic, a visible manifestation rather than just all happening in their heads, as I worried the psychic powers would feel. It wasn't part of the original brainstorming session, but played well with the other parts of the narrative. However, as I approached the end of the first third of the story and realized I needed to up the stakes, Sack offered the perfect opportunity. She could show Dusk his corpse. Could she show the corpse of the island, too? Could I devise an event so dangerous it drove Dusk to cross the island at night, towing a half-trained home Isler? Could I put the entire island at risk? Cracking this problem gave me the bulk of my story. The ones above, which were something I first intended to simply be a reference to set this story in the Cosmere, became more central to the plot. Vothi's devices from the ones above turned into the means by which I generated my big inciting incident. I liked this, as it allowed for another layer of new meets old, further entrenching the themes of the story. Indeed, Dusk's own themes as a character. I wrote without major difficulty until the climax. It came together perfectly, and then the story had no ending. It had a great climax, but that wasn't the ending. Something huge was missing. A bigger problem. My climax wasn't my ending. This is rare for me, and is difficult to spot in an outline. Looking at the story structurally, I'd built it with several bracketing story layers. Each idea listed below is a plot cycle in the story that needed addressing. Relationship. Dusk and the island. Relationship, Dusk and Vothi. Objective, cross the island. Relationship, Dusk and Vothi. Relationship, Dusk and the island. I introduced Dusk and his relationship to his island first, then introduced Vothi and the theme of modernity versus tradition. Then finally I introduced the objective of crossing the island. These were our three main plots or themes of the story, but my climax only covered two of them. I was able to close the bracket on crossing the island and able to give a climax to the theme of old and new by having the island's secret get out. But at the end, I had no closing bracket to Dusk himself. Beyond that, I felt the theme of modernity versus tradition was only weakly explored. As explosively as the center bracket was executed, the story felt weak because of the two other brackets. I came up with something to tie off the story and end it, but it gave only the lamest placeholder for closing that bracket. This problem hung me up for months. What was the right ending to this story? What would give emotional closure to my protagonist? I ran the story through my writing group, then chatted with the author crew. I did that whole workshop session on the story, but never came to an understanding of the ending. It was problematic for me because often my ending and climax align quite well. Not so in this case. The right questions. Before I made any headway on the story, I had to start asking myself questions. What promises was I making in the text? What nagging emotions did I have at the end making me feel like the story didn't give me what I wanted? Also, in turn, what did the alpha and beta readers like about the story? What was its soul, and what was working? I had to make sure I didn't ruin any of that. And in addition, perhaps what they were enjoying would give me a hint on what to emphasize in the next draft. I've posted all of my notes from my writing group session at the end of this essay, if you want to take a listen. These questions really helped me identify the problems with the story. I started to feel that the weakness of my ending was due to me not actually understanding Dusk's relationship with the island. What were his emotions? The writing group's comments helped me start thinking along these lines as well. I needed a more complex relationship between Dusk and Pachi before I could develop a satisfying ending. The second issue is that I felt like I'd cheated the ending. I realized that one thing I wanted as a reader was to know more about the device and the ones above. I felt that glossing over that aspect of the ending had created a major part of the weakness. I wanted to either see the device, or at least have some kind of resolution involving it. More than just, yeah, this worked, we're good. I toyed with several different emotional connections between Pachi and Dusk until I hit upon the idea that made it all start to work. Dusk being angry at Pachi, then discovering that there was a reason for all of this danger. At least, a reason in Dusk's mind. I was able to tie this to the ones above more deeply, then turn the island and its traps into a greater metaphor for the future at large. One thing the writing group loved was the idea that the ones above were trying to get around a prime directive-style set of laws preventing them from taking advantage of a less advanced culture. I had this as a fun little revelation, but I realized that I'd tossed this one in too freely and that it really should be the climax. This is the unusual occurrence of an instance where something minor I'd added to the story, the ones above, along with a tiny subplot revelation that they're trying to find a way to trade for the birds, became the hook that I expanded to become the climax of the entire story. At long last, after almost a year of trying, I had the ending of my story. Application and conclusion. One of the things that fascinates me about the writing process is the way craft and art work together. Knowing the bones of how to create a sympathetic character is craft, like knowing which brush to choose when approaching the painting of a specific landscape feature. Yet the craftsmanship is overseen by the artistic sense, which is not nearly so easy to define. The tools are defined by the craft, but the art is defined by what feels right. One has to do with which nut to use with which bolt, and the other with the awe of a beautiful automobile. I've said before that when I'm writing, I work on instinct, letting the artist dominate. During outlining and revision, however, the craftsman is more in charge. My experience with Sixth of the Dusk illustrates this. The artist knew something was wrong with the story, and so I stepped back and let the craftsman suggest tools and solutions, which the artist could then try out one after another until I hit on something that worked. My process might not be your process, but it's likely that this alliance between craftsperson and artist is going to be a part of it. In working with students, I've come to believe that relying too much on tools, schema, or archetypes when writing can easily lead to wooden stories. However, not understanding your process and the tools you're using can leave you in a very difficult position when something isn't working and you can't explain why. Writer's block, as a whole, seems to have some roots in this conflict. I can also envision this specific problem, having a climax that is not an ending, popping up in your own writing. If you run into it, try asking yourself what promises you've made in the first half of the story, and examine if your climax, albeit dramatic, is fulfilling the wrong promises. Your solution may not be to change the ending, but instead to change the promises. In this story, I did both. First by adding Dusk's frustration with Pachi as a foreshadowing of a later resolution, then by moving the revelation regarding the true plans of the ones above to overlap Dusk's coming understanding. It took well over 18 months to get this one story right, but I'm supremely satisfied at having stuck to it and wiggled out the answers. Not just because I now have an awesome story to share with others, but because I feel I've learned another tidbit about my process and the writing experience as a whole. Brandon Sanderson, April 18th, 2014. Writing group notes for Sixth of the Dusk. My writing group at this time included Ben and Danielle Olson, Alan Layton, Kaylin Zobel, Kathleen Sanderson, Peter and Karen Alstrom, Isaac and Kara Stewart, and Emily Sanderson. We did the writing group session for this story in four chunks, and I've left a note by each part saying how much of the story that session included. In writing group, we first mention things we like about the story. You can hear from my revisions and essay that this can sometimes be as important as the critiques of what isn't working, as in revision I took one idea, the prime directive idea, that readers liked and moved it to become more central to the story. This was a big part of my path to fixing the ending. You will hear that I took many critiques, but not all. That's common. I also sometimes make notes of who said something just in case I need to ask for future clarification. But also, I know these people really well, and sometimes noting who said what can help me understand the context of the comment when I'm doing revisions months later, as I can match the words to the person. One final thing to note is that at the end of the fourth session, we meet once a week, so we went over this story for about a month, one quarter each week. We brainstormed to fix the ending. None of these ideas ended up being ones that I used, but the experience was still helpful in driving me to think about what kinds of promises I had made in the story. Part 1. Beginning Until Dusk Finds Vathi. Good things? Like the psychic link to the animals? World is fascinating? Shadow under boat? Islands being gods is very cool. Critiques.
I got confused about how it was an archipelago. It's a line. But there's a middle? Are his cargo pants wet from being in surf? Or did he put them on after?
I think he should put them on after sailing in his loincloth. How big are the islands? How long does it take to pass them? Are they Hawaii-type islands?
Beginning too slow?
Mm-hmm. I get bored when people aren't talking.
The trapper chooses his island. It sounds like he's out to choose his island for the first time. Should you establish earlier that he's chosen his island? Another question. Do they stay? Never leave? It seemed that they stayed.
What age is Dusk? Didn't discover it until later. Most thought he was older. Should he think, while tracking in the jungle, does this person want me to follow them? Is this a trap? Part 2. Up until he decides to leave into the forest. Good things. Creepy scene where the birds all go nuts and he sees his body everywhere was great. They ask me not to kill Dusk. Like his inner characterization. They say I'm getting really good at these shorter fantasies. Feels very fleshed out. Critiques. Isaac really wants a good payoff for this awesome scene where the birds freak out.
Am I supposed to like Vathi? Because I don't.
He's got two AVR who do two different things. Do all of them show people how they can die, or does every bird have its own trick?
They have questions about what happened to her bird. The net was to numb her, but she didn't seem numbed. Ben was a little confused. Did she remain numb? She did things with no impediment. Part 3. Up until the night maw is killed. Good things. Liked when he brought the bird over to show her so she'd go with him?
I like how little he tells her. I like that he thinks to himself what not to tell her. I also liked him wanting to kill all the night maws.
She keeps talking. And there's never any thought of predators may hear us if she keeps talking. Would it at least annoy him or give him anxiety?
Well, should he think about it more, having the bird give her visions? It runs a risk of showing her something that will lead to secrets being figured out.
Some felt it was too abrupt when the night maw showed up. Others liked that abruptness. No mention of how she was holding her blunderbuss. Unclear how it looked. Did she set it? Was she holding it correctly? Also a ton of smoke. Part 4. Until the ending. Good things. Liked the, they're trying to get us to break the prime directive so they can break the prime directive. Liked both of the characters for their intelligence and the reveals. Liked talking to the island in his head. Critiques. The tree with the flowers didn't try to kill them. The other one with the flowers did, right? Why didn't it attract predators? Why not hide in the lake? Ben lost where they were. A lot of the group had blocking issues here. Also, it's dark. How much can they see? Is there a moon? When they're hiding, she talks and talks and talks and talks, not worried about being heard. Maybe night moths can't hear well? Kaylin wanted him to notice the flower solution, not Vathi. If he was going to die, should he have given her the book and the other guy's book to protect the birds? Brainstorms with group to fix ending. So should there be more of a sense that the island is forcing him to give up its secrets? It wants the secrets out, so how do I interpret that? Could he gain something on the island that stops them from being able to find the Aviar? Could she become his protege? What happens if he ingests the worms? Sail away, think about how the island is forcing him to give up secrets, and sail back toward the fortress? Bird should have something to do with it, right?
Shadows Beneath, the Writing Excuses Anthology, is a graphic audio production. Published by special arrangement with Dragonsteel Entertainment, LLC, and the individual authors. Production copyright 2016, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Unauthorized download and or duplication prohibited. Introduction to Shadows Beneath, the Writing Excuses Anthology, narrated by Nick DePinto as Brandon Sanderson. A Fire in the Heavens by Mary Robinette Kowal. Copyright 2014 by Mary Robinette Kowal. Performed by Colleen Delaney, narrator. Kimberly Gilbert as Caton. Michael John Casey as Stillian. Mort Shelby as Lisid. And James Konacek as Apex. With Gregory Linnington, Chris Davenport, Lily Beacon, Christopher Graybill, Tim Getman, Bob Payne, Dylan Lynch, Andy Brownstein, Jeff Allen, Nanette Savard, Shanta Parasharaman, Elizabeth Jernigan, Danny Stoller, Scott Graham, Scott McCormick, Rose Elizabeth Supan, and James Lewis. An Honest Death by Howard Taylor. Copyright 2014 by the Taylor Corporation. Performed by Richard Rowan and Terence Aselford, narrators. Richard Rowan as Blakely and Cole, Terence Aselford as McDonald and Valreich, Thomas Penny as Mohammed, Dylan Lynch as Michelle, and Scott McCormick as Death. With Mort Shelby, Rose Elizabeth Supan, Colleen Delaney, Thomas Keegan, and Yasmin Toison. Notes on An Honest Death, narrated by Scott Graham as Howard Taylor. I.E. Demon by Dan Wells. Copyright 2014 by Fearful Symmetry, LLC. Performed by Eric Messner and Dylan Lynch, narrators. Eric Messner as the patrol commander, Evan Casey as the engineer, Ken Jackson as the demon, and Thomas Keegan as the gunner. With Tim Getman, Chris Davenport, Todd Schofield, Patrick Bussink, Paul Reisman, Bill Gillette, Mort Shelby, Chris Gennebach, and David Jordan. I.E. Demon, an essay, narrated by Steve Wanall as Dan Wells. Sixth of the Dusk by Brandon Sanderson. Copyright 2014 by Dragonsteel Entertainment, LLC. All rights reserved. Performed by Terence Aselford, narrator. Ken Jackson as Sixth of the Dusk. Dawn Ursula as Vathi. And Colleen Delaney as Mother. With Thomas Penny, Mort Shelby, James Lewis, and Kimberly Gilbert. When Your Story's Climax Isn't an Ending. Performed by Nick DePinto as Brandon Sanderson, narrator, Michael Glenn as Isaac, Lise Bruneau as Kaylin, Deidre Starnes as Karen, Andy Brownstein as Peter, and Nanette Savard as Kathy. Additional red shirts by the Dead Giveaways. The brainstorming and workshopping sessions participants are Brandon Sanderson, Mary Robinette Kowal, Howard Taylor, Dan Wells, and Eric James Stone. Directed by Rose Elizabeth Supan. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Johann Detweiler, John Glennon, Nathaniel Perry, and Justin Wirtz. Original music by Johann Detweiler. Stories adapted for graphic audio by Johann Detweiler. If you enjoyed the Shadows Beneath anthology, be sure to listen to Brandon Sanderson's Mistborn, Elantris, and Warbreaker series, all available in graphic audio at Road Stops Everywhere, at 1-800-670-5220, or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our action-pumped titles, as well as free downloads and podcasts. Now keep listening for exciting previews of other titles in graphic audio. If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can select from over 900 titles and 60 series in either CD or high-quality download formats. If you would like to listen to an entire series, you can conveniently purchase the whole sets on CD or USB flash drive from graphicaudio.net. At graphicaudio.net, you can now earn loyalty rewards points, redeemable toward future online purchases. You can also get full mobile downloads directly to your phone or tablet with our new Graphic Audio Access app, available on all Android and Apple devices, so you can listen on the go, anytime, anywhere. Call 1-800-670-5220 or visit www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our email newsletter, like us on Facebook, or follow us on Twitter.